Okay, my name is Jennifer Barr. I'm from Christiana Care Health System in Delaware. I have no financial disclosures. All right, so our program is similar to the past two that you heard, so I'll try to skip through the repetition. We've been growing together for 6 years and steal ideas off each other, so it's good. For you to understand moving women forward, you have to understand Delaware. We are located in Wilmington, which is the city, in Newcastle County. We have three counties in the entire state. 60% of our population are in Newcastle County. So that's where we focus most of our activities in. We have extremely high rates of diabetes, high rates of obesity, high rates of cancer. The infant mortality is 8.8. It is 17 for African American families in Wilmington. So there was a need for such services. Our department is called Center for Community Health. We are growing. I wanted to make sure you saw everything that we do within our department. We have two campuses, one in the city in Wilmington, one in Newark. We have Wilmington's about 68,000 patients a year, and we see 11,000 OBGYN clinics. So that's per year. So we are the main healthcare provider for the state of Delaware. Moving women forward came out of our Center for Excellence in Community Health, so you'll hear me talk about that a lot. So our Center for Community Health did a needs assessment, and we had funded in 2005. The funding started around $250,000. We got awarded $250,000, got cut to $150,000, and then by the time we received our notification, we got to $143,000 a year. So our original budget, HRSA, it wasn't your fault. Our original budget got more than sliced in half. So our goal was to reach 300 women in the end of 3 years, and we had peanuts to do it with. And we knew there was a need. Our CCOE, our Center for Excellence in Community Health, did a needs assessment and asked what women's main health concerns were, and one of them was weight management. We also knew that they had fear of getting bad news and they didn't seek medical care. So we built our program around this and our admissions data. So we built Moving Women Forward through this. It targeted at-risk communities that we knew had really high BMIs. We had our programs at FQHCs, WICs, community centers, faith-based groups, hospitals, clinics, anywhere in that center that people felt comfortable and we could have a program. We had peanuts to work with, right? So we couldn't pay for space anymore. We had a very small budget for food demonstrations, not a lot for staff anymore. Terry is behind Vanna. You raise your hand, Terry. She was my community health liaison or team leader. And Terry got cut down to 6 hours a week. She was supposed to be full-time. Okay. Instead of being the manager, I was also the main educator. So we sacrificed things to do this program. What did a Moving Women Forward client look like? Majority were African-American and had a very large BMI. We'll talk about that in a second, but we decided to use a family approach because of the ages that were coming in were middle-aged women. But what we were seeing is they were bringing their mom, their grandmother, their aunt, their sister, their neighbor. So we had to open our doors, similar to what Cassandra and Erica were saying, to the whole family. We knew this was low-income populations as well, so we used low-literacy information. How healthy was our group? A quarter had reported high blood pressure. This is all self-reported. Our model is based on stages of change and health belief model. So a quarter reported back pain, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. About 12 to 14% had type 2 diabetes, depression, and stress. The first year, I think it should be noted that 41% of our participants reported depression. In the first year we were at homeless shelters, women's correction, which we'll talk about, and a couple day centers, like safe places for women to go. So right away, we partnered with our Mental Health Association of Delaware and developed a program called Beyond Stress. We knew the stigma with depression, like Cassandra was talking about, and we just put it right into our curriculum so there was resources and it was a safe place to talk about it. I love this line. CCOE taught us that you include the medical students in what you do. It's part of our job to teach them about diversity of our community and that our population is not compliant. It's not compliant. There's issues going in as to why they don't come to their appointments on time or show up, why they don't take their medicines. So it's our job to show our medical team that. So what we do is, we're not doing it right now, there's a break in the education, but our residents and our medical students follow our women. So they'll come to the first session, it's 8 weeks, and they can pick whoever they want, whoever they feel attracted to, if you will, and they will follow that person. And my favorite thing is that a medical student, after 4 weeks, emails me. He said, I can't believe that she's not taking her medicine because she couldn't afford it. And she finally just told me over the phone, when I called to see how she was doing with her goals, we do SMART goals every week and call them, and he was calling her to see how she was doing on her goal, and then he finally found out that she wasn't taking her medicine because she was spreading it out because she couldn't afford it. And it was like his aha moment, you know, and he went back to the medical students and shared his experience, and that's when we said this has got to be a permanent part of family and community medicine. So this is our curriculum. We call it the Live It series. Diet's horrible. What's in the word diet? Die. Why in the world would you go on that? Okay. So live it up. Enjoy life. Okay. And that's what we came up with. I am anal. I didn't like any of the curriculum. I liked the Learn Institute, the Cooper Institute. I love those books, but they were just written for rich white people. So it just wasn't appropriate for what we were doing, and they weren't culturally specific foods. The language is really bad. So we just used pieces of that and put it down to a different level and made our own curriculum. And it worked out really well for us. So it's 8 weeks. We started out as 12 weeks. And remember, we had to cut money, so we kept it 8 weeks. But it turned out that when CCOE did our first pilot program at 12 weeks, people dropped off after 8 weeks. So it actually ended up working well for our attendance because over 75%, more than half the people completed six or more classes, which is really good in terms of that. We have a dietitian and a team leader at every program. The team leader was someone from that community, someone they trusted. We know that works, right? We did food demonstrations because as part of food education, you have to taste it and get self-efficacy. Learn, have that confidence to cook the food and feel comfortable with it. So that was a big part of our program, is to taste the food and then have incentives built in. Pedometers, they work. Writing down what you eat, people who write it down lose twice as much weight as people who don't. So using those models is part of that. What made us unique? Most women in our program did not have a healthcare provider or seen a healthcare provider in the past year. We knew that's a priority. We know women's primary care doctors, what, they're OBGYN, right? And they probably don't follow up. And then we also knew that we're dealing with women who had depression, and they reported it. That was only self-reported. And we knew they were only self-reporting a quarter had high blood pressure. And we know how many people had high blood pressure and didn't report it. So Terry was instrumental in getting 100% referrals. 100% after 3 years. Every single person that referred, we had acted on that referral. We kept our program free, and then the calendar. Like Erica put out the calendar, we do the same thing. Which I felt is unique is that we would run our programs at the same time, two different days a week. So if you missed Monday, say you were like a shift worker, you can go to another class, and we would fill you in. So you never had the opportunity to miss anything. Grocery market tours. We did health screenings. We didn't have to pay for any of this stuff. We called our state. We're like, can you give us hemoglobin A1C screenings? They're really sick. And they came. And that was a state employee. They didn't share the data, though. But you know what? You got to chalk it up. They were getting screened, and they had access to their numbers. Lots of exercise programs. At the time, soul line dancing was huge. In fact, our person that we funded to do all the programs is on TV now, Soline TV. We made her famous. And then Sit and Be Fit was actually a program for disabilities. When you think of disabilities, you may think of MS or CP or something of that sort, but when you're really overweight, you are disabled. And that's what we were seeing a lot of. The next couple slides are spin-offs of the program. Because we were doing well, other organizations contacted us. One was WIC. So we actually, within every WIC clinic, had our own program throughout the state of Delaware, where we focused on the parents and then the children. And I convinced University of Delaware undergrad and graduate public health students to do the program for free as part of their service learning. They had to get 6 to 8 hours. And then our expanded food and nutrition program wrote the curriculum as a grad project, so we didn't have to pay for that. The correction facilities, we had Gwen, who was a mental health social worker at the prison, called me. Her daughter was in Moving Women Forward and said, you know, people are having babies sent back to the prison, and then they're giving a brochure on postpartum depression and then infirmary by themselves for 3 days. So she got me in the prison, which I didn't realize how political that was. And we're still there every Tuesday morning. And we're not going anywhere. because those women are having babies and they don't have the support they're doing. We're attempting to implement a breast pumping program on the people that are on certain medications so that they can feel connected to their babies. Camp Fresh spread out of the kids. The moms complained that the kids needed something to do in the summer because they were getting in trouble. We had a DuPont Trust Fund that we were using for school-age kids. Our awesome out-of-the-box thinking team came up with Camp Fresh, fresh resources everyone should have, and we had our first urban garden in the city. It won an award, and I have nothing to do with this program anymore because it's its own program. It's awesome. And they sell produce. They market to the community for it. We had a diabetes program. Every year we have an award ceremony for our women because you have to celebrate them. And the families have to understand my mom was gone every Monday night. So it was an opportunity for that. And then the biggest thing, our partners gave us so much of their time and resources that we would honor our partners that really contributed to it. We give out this Crystal Apple Award. It was like $50. We did a press release, and it made all the difference. That's Terry. She actually got an award. 100 pounds later, by the way. Go Terry. This is probably one of the biggest impacts that we had is the Yes You Can. Vicki George approached our CCOE and said, you know, people who have disabilities can be active too. We started a partnership where we had exercise and weight management program for them. We had two pilots. Over 20 people participated. It is its own entity. It's a 501c3. Last 2 weeks ago, the mayor's wife actually just presented them with an award. They go skiing, they do rock climbing, and they do hang gliding type activities. So it's a pretty impressive program, and we help them with evaluation because that was the part they didn't get. They didn't understand they had to show change, so we'd help them. Okay. So everyone had a change, 4 pounds average weight loss, high satisfaction rate. You know, we made a difference in these communities. 1,500 people participated. Do you remember our goal? 300. Remember how much money we had? This was huge for us. We have 742 people completed pre or post test. So we definitely made a difference and significant changes in these people's lives. This is my favorite part. Okay. So the program's over, what do? You know, where's the money coming from? So $100, I convinced our health system to do this. For $100, they get a stipend and they can have their own Moving Women Forward program. And I'm happy to say that, and we train them to do it, called a community health mentor, that it's still going on now. We've managed to have centers have their own programming where we'll help them with evaluation, we'll print out the curriculum for them, we'll pass them our 5 pounds of fat and salt test tubes, and Terry will follow up. And we're still having programs. In fact, we are the people that people in the community go to when they want to have a program. So when we have them running right now. Lots of lessons learned. I don't think it's anything new that what all the lovely ladies here said today. Terry always says attitude and presence, and I think that's a really big part of us. If you have the attitude that you can lose weight and be healthy, that it'll happen, and we show up. People know us because we don't cancel class. We had to cancel because we had a hurricane. But otherwise, we don't cancel class. We are there, and they know it, and they know they can depend on us. Thank you to Vanna, who's not on there, Drayton, and Lisa for letting me change people's lives.
Hi, I'll just start the discussion. Debbie Walker. I was privileged to be part of this. Dr. Drayton over here was the evaluator that looked at all of these programs, and you guys are really amazing and very inspirational. But I want to make a couple of observations, because when I looked at all of the findings, well, you have the best of the best here presenting, which was fantastic. And clearly those of you who use the social determinants approach, understood the community, understood family, had staff that were close to the community, and all that really did well. There were a few others that probably had more challenges in that way. I think you're terrific, and I'm ready to sign up. But here's the question. Here's my big question I'd like to talk about is, how do we then turn this into much more evidence-based that the funders, not Lisa, I know she's working on it, Mike will help her, but how could we need to get these so the insurers pay for it. In other words, you guys have shown, even though it's a pre-post, so you don't have comparison groups, which they will never look at, that in fact some of this works. And, you know, like if the United States Preventive Services Task Force looks at this, which they do, and they do all their evidence reviews, this wouldn't count. So I hope we can, even though, and I also have a lot of problems with science that demands all the comparisons, because in a way this is a quality improvement model and you've shown it in an ongoing cycle, but we don't really always accept that kind of data. So that's a challenge, and I accept it with you. How do we figure out how to take this? First of all, I know that Devon and Lisa are working on trying to get this published just as out there in the qualitative, because that's important as well. And then I think we have to work on ways, and maybe there's a way within you guys as programs we could, you all could come together, somebody could help do that so that you could really put some of those numbers in real places too. And not all of the programs that were funded had the numbers that some of you do. So that's one challenge, and I mean, I accept it for all of us, because unfortunately, you have it. It's kind of like reinventing the wheel. So I would like to see these kind of things. It's not rocket science, but I'd like to know if, and this is a question for you guys, how much would it really take? Is it one person, a half a person? That's an interesting thing that I hope you guys can help with too. You had some things that were very similar, but if I wanted to fund this and I had my insurer and said, it's going to take X, I need to know that, and then the return on investment. And you guys are close to be able to answer that. I'd like to see this actually become a component of our Healthy Start programs. We've been close to those programs, too. There's 104 of them. This would be fantastic. And they also are addressing high-risk African-American and Latino women. And then the only other thing I just wanted to say is I'd be interested, too, in the settings about the staff who are involved, because isn't, you know, if you take this into a community health center, for instance, don't you also have to include the community health center staff so they feel empowered as well, those that have the, you know, so how do we make that work as well? So I really thank you all. It was a privilege to hear you. I think we've got some really serious, you know, challenges ahead to take this to scale. I'd be interested in your responses on that. You're up.
Well, I'm Wendy Hellerston. I wonder if we should give people, do any of our speakers want to respond, actually, to Dr. Walker's comments?
Well, I can come on up.
So I can respond to that final question, because I am part of an FQHC, and so our program is run in a clinic. And I feel like for us, just to use my program as an example, and I ran out of time, I think to get the involvement of everyone within the clinic is key. And while our program is available to community members and our patients, we recognize it's the providers that's endorsing it for us. And what we found in our community is, you know, that provider's recommendation or suggestion to the patient carries a lot of weight. It's a lot easier or patients seem to be more willing to participate when we say, well, Dr. Fox said that you should be attending this program, instead of me saying, well, you should attend. So I think having that coordination and the involvement of all of our staff, from providers to MAs to front desk staff, is really key.
The question, thank you, and the question I was getting at, in some of the settings I've seen,
Well, right. So, right. So we also kind of then have involved our staff within our programs. We offer employee health services as well that tap into these same topics. We invite them to participate. And so I think just having this culture of health within your clinic, you know, the whole taking the stairs and all of those things that we hear about, but enforcing those not only in our patients but in our clinic staff and having those messages everywhere, I think has been really an important part of our program and getting the word out.
In terms of financing this, you asked that question.
Yeah, if somebody said, okay, what do I really need to make this program?
Well, right now I could bill for this. Yes, I can. As a public health dietitian, which I highly recommend you hire, MPHRD, full-time, that it's important because we can bill for group nutrition education. For a session of our time constraints, I could make $42.36 an hour in Delaware per person, per hour, I'm sorry, per class. So, you know, I don't know if you've been, some of our classes, we have over 25 people come. You know, so they have to have health insurance. And then, you know, the people that didn't have health insurance, it would fill in the void and it would be okay. So it is a program that you can bill, and that's actually part of our sustainability is to start doing that in the community. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, first of all, I think it's a very, very good program, but I would have some concerns about evaluation. Some of the indicators that should be there, mm-hmm. and also how to measure because now funders are looking at evaluation. Evaluation is so critical. And just to address to Dr. I'm sorry, what's your name?
Debbie's fine.
Debbie.
Yes, Debbie.
We talk a lot about evaluation, but I think there needs to be consistent training. I do not see that when individuals are developing and implementing their programs, but there's not a lot of evaluation training. I don't think that a lot of our healthcare professionals, they really know how to do the evaluation, and perhaps it may take an evaluation expert to come in, because evaluation is important. You know, I would want to know, in terms of like when you say depression, for that these women have are going through depression, how many, is there a link with that? Because the food and the healthy nutrition and depression is linked with that.
We actually asked a lot of these questions.
Right. Have they overcome, or do you put them in counseling with that counseling? Because that's part, you could have a comprehensive approach.
Our evaluation, and Vanna, you know, we wouldn't be here if Anna Drayton didn't take the time to look at our evaluation data, but it was in collaboration with the University of Delaware and a pre and post survey that we actually piloted before we even went into the communities. You have something?
My second concern is in terms of your curriculum. I heard you say the comments that the curriculum was for rich.
Sorry, I didn't mean to offend anyone. Right.
But I want to know, in developing your curriculum, did you get the input of your target population?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah.
That's very, very important. And the types of foods, the types of things input, because that's important. What I'm finding when these programs are developed, a lot of times we as health professionals, we like to develop on our own. We do not get the input of our target population in developing.
We had focus groups and, oh yeah, let's Terry's the.
That's what I was going to say. You know, I'm a me person. Mm-hmm. And me, I'm the community.
Oh my goodness.
And my community is where my children play, where I go to work, where my church is, where I live, not just my neighborhood. So they saw this. In that picture, I was a whole bunch of fans. Okay. And by being a part of this curriculum, you know, Jen didn't say, Terry, you had to lose weight to be a part of this. You know, I went in as I am, and that's what they saw. When I called them on the phone, and I said, Debbie, you promised to drink a glass of water. You drink an extra glass of water a day, and you'll say, Terry, you know, because I became a friend, I made her more comfortable. As a team leader, I was making her more comfortable. So she drank the extra glass of water. So guess what, y'all? I realized I couldn't drink a glass of water. And so she helped me, I helped her. And that's how it is. And we have that team leader, I think that Cassandra and Eric will say the same thing. We got that person, it's just like them. You know, because still, you know, as African Americans, we used to scratch. Okay? Grandma cooked for me. Grandma said you got the other thing off your plate. Okay? We found that was wrong. The way she cooked it, and how much I ate. Okay, and that's what they're learning, because they saw me. And because I saw them, we did it together. And that's the type of thing.
I want to thank you for empowering this group to run their own program, because that's something that we don't do a lot of.
Yeah.
Thank you for empowering them to run their program.
Well, we don't live there, so.
So why don't you make
sure. Well, actually, I'm just enjoying the conversation. I think this is what this is about. We're all interested. Like you, I actually led obesity interventions for a long time, and of course, I've had lifelong obesity, and I think it didn't hurt that I rather understood the issues. My first diet was at the age of 9 months. One of the things I was asked to do, because we had a long talk, Dr. Drayton and I on the phone, is, well, what are we going to do when we have interventions that maybe don't have striking results, the evaluation you just talked about? Well, none of these interventions came up here and said women lost on average 40 pounds. But you know what? We sat here and we listened to this, didn't we? And what did we hear? We heard these generous interventions, these comprehensive interventions, these interventions that were looking at women very holistically. And I'm afraid I just can't critique it. I mean, there's no reason to provide criticism here. I think what we really have to do is think about how we can help women be fit. And that's what these interventions are talking about. They're talking about mental and physical health. And I agree with you about the empowering. I'm looking at you, and I'm thinking, you're right about evaluation. I'm with you. I'm an epidemiologist. We do that. I got it. And I did this kind of research. I get it. But we also have to think about how can we help women be healthy. Period, and that's, I know where you're coming from. You know what the reality is? And you all know it. Most weight loss interventions involving nutrition and physical activity have very modest effects. Long term, they have even more modest effects. But these people achieved something. And actually, I think they came out with participants who were healthier. Now, one of the things that they may be teaching us, and I want to play with this idea because it's important to me. I have wondered if overweight and obesity particularly has more than just a couple of etiologies. I got out of the obesity business because it was all about gluttony and sloth. If they would just stop eating and exercising, there'd be no problems. It's really their fault if you think about it. It's my fault. It's all of our faults. But the reality is, what are you going to do with data that tell you that a 10-year-old who's obese has an 80% chance of being obese when she's 35? What's that kind of tell you? Does it tell you that, well, there's just a life course of gluttony and sloth? Or does it tell you that maybe there's a different kind of physiology going on there, especially with early onset obesity? And I just want us to just kind of think a little bit. One of the things that we know, too, about obesity and overweight, and I was scrambling these things down, is not only maybe does it have a variety of etiologies, but it also changes physiology. Obesity, the condition, changes physiology. I'm at high risk for chronic inflammation, right? I'm obese, this would be it. Metabolic disorders. We have to understand that a little bit better, and there is research looking at women with metabolic disorder and the scores of millions of women in the U.S., and how can you intervene to help them lose weight. So we want to think about it. The other thing I really think about, and this resonated when I heard the compassion and the creativity of these people, is that obese people are not only maybe physically different and physiologically and biologically different, but they may be psychologically different than normal weight people, especially if you look at duration and chronicity of obesity. I mean, really, honestly, think about it. Obesity, and I know this varies by culture, is highly stigmatized. I mean, let's face it, the obese or the, let's just say it, the fat woman is always mocked in films and television. I mean, she's, you laugh at her, and particularly if she starts to exercise, because then she really looks funny. The thing is that people with chronic obesity grow up with those images, and they really internalize those. Well, I'm assuming that everyone does. But I wonder if some of the psychological effects of obesity are different for women with lifelong experiences compared to those for whom obesity maybe came much later in life. You internalize the negative body image, and you internalize the, I look really funny when I exercise, so I'm not gonna. And it's really funny when fat women sweat, so I'm not going to do that. That's not being recalcitrant. That's not being non-compliant. I'm so tired of the whole idea of compliance. That's not what that's about. We also have some great data, and it's, we still need to look at this more, is that certain kind of histories around food can affect obesity. We know that women who have childhood experiences of food insecurity, not enough food in the house, are at really high risk for obesity as adults. Well, why the heck is that? Yeah, you can say food patterns, so she just stopped eating. Well, just as we were told, you know, what is the word diet? I actually shouted out deprivation. And the idea of reducing calories and inducing hunger to women who have known hunger ain't as sweet as you think it is. And it really can really result in a lot of stress that's related to not wanting to do better for your health, but stress that's just related to the intervention itself. So I was thinking about a lot of things. I was thinking maybe obesity is a lot of things. Maybe overweight is a lot of things. And maybe the kind of compassion we heard here, maybe the kind of celebration of health that we heard here can make us be a little looser on the fact that not big weight loss. But healthier women is what I would guess. And the other thing, and I know I'm going on and for people to respond to, but man, oh man, you know, those of us who are public health professionals and academics, we're a little bit a part of the problem. 20 years ago, I did interventions that involved very low-calorie diets. That's what we did. And they were clinical trials, and we told you to eat 800 calories a day. You'd lose weight. I was fat, but not this fat. But the point is, what we found is, we made people, well, this was very common. 20 years ago, come on, that's what people were doing. Women would lose weight, sure. And then we'd see them 6 months later, and they'd gain 10% of their baseline weight. This isn't uncommon. We introduced failure to a lot of women. We told them, if you try to diet, you're going to really screw up, baby. Because we're going to screw you up. Now, what happened is we didn't have proper knowledge. We tried to publish, and we did publish some of our results, but the reality is editors want success stories. They don't want to hear that 6 months later they were 10% heavier than they were at baseline. So a lot of the stuff about the very low-calorie diets, while they're out there, we couldn't get published. So we have a responsibility to really search for the evidence wherever we can. I was thinking, too, about one thing we used to tell women to do. Drink diet soda. Satisfy you. Yeah, well, screw up your teeth. But the Nurses' Health Study just found out that aspartame is related to low atrial fibrillation in middle-aged women. So, you know, maybe that wasn't the best idea. Yeah, heart disease. Maybe not the best idea in the world. It's just as bad as MSG. But we told people to do it. So what we as academics, we've got to do this. We've got to deal with evidence, just as been said here. We have to deal with uncertainty, too. Because the reality is, 20 years ago, we were saying very low-calorie diets. The same investigators I was working with, I went into reproductive health after a while, but are now promulgating low-carb, high-fat diets. The same guys. We need to present uncertainty in a way that the public can understand. And then the public media, we got to speak up. I mean, it's really the caveman diet, the vegan diet, the low-carb, the high-carb diet. Now, I'm on a different diet every day. Of course, they're never the same. The thing is, it's really stupid, isn't it? And how are people, how is the public to manage all of this information? And that's, it's up to us. We have to help them manage it. Fruit and vegetables, I can't say anything wrong with them. And we got to say that strong and strong and strong. But so these are just some thoughts I had. And my thoughts are, I guess, as an epidemiologist, I would just be an awful person about, well, how much weight did they lose? What change in BMI did they have? But I think it's awfully complex. And what I really liked hearing were programs that probably made some change in the health of women and may continue to do that and may actually change the health of their families. So I got nothing in terms of critique, but I just do want to put out a challenge that this obesity stuff is pretty sticky. There's probably not one answer. So any responses to that?
So I work on the west side of Chicago in a pretty low-income area. I mentioned in the presentation that, across the street from where our clinic is, actually is like the one supermarket that has some fresh produce. And so we're able to provide that to the women. But then what we do a lot of educating on is, you know, where to go for like produce mobiles, so where they can get fresh produce for free. And then we also do give out recipes and information about like frozen foods and canned foods, and at least something like that. If you don't have easy access to the fresh produce, here's something that you can do with frozen or canned. And so I'd say, even though I am in a very low income area, we are fortunate that there is some accessibility. If they come to the group, then they're right across the street, even though they might not live so close by. We provide transit cards to get to the group. And so what sometimes happens is then they just go across the street after our group, and then we have the transit cards to get them back home by the bus.
I have two comments on that. One is access, and the second one is policy. So Camp Fresh, those high school students did the USDA food outlet survey at the corner stores, and they asked the questions, knocked on door to door, about access to fresh fruits and vegetables, and fresh also including frozen.
And fresh also including frozen, and they surveyed the city, and what we found out, you know, that was we empowered the students to understand that that was a food desert, and they actually submitted their findings in a report to the mayor. And Wilmington now is not a food desert in these areas. There's actually a grocery store at ShopRite and Southbridge and at the waterfront. So they were part of that. So that's access, and then the urban garden. It's the second one with the farmer's market. So we actually helped solve that problem. And the second thing I wanted to say is policy. You know, the women were going into the grocery store that they had, and it was Acme. It's so horrible. And we did a food demonstration with, like, yogurt and fruit or something like that, and, like, fruit in its own juice, okay? It's, like, 60 cents. It's really cheap. But all they had was in heavy syrup. So we empowered them to talk to the manager. What I didn't realize is they were all going to go after class, 25 of them deep. But guess what? They have canned fruit in its own juice now at that Acme. So I think that's part of it.
Jennifer, from the time that the kids went to their door, collected the information, letter to the mayor, and the time they actually got a grocery store.
They weren't the main reason. There was a lot of other forces together. What do you guys say? That happened? 2007 is when the surveys started. When did ShopRite come in? This is back there. It's just Harry. It just happened last year, right?
3 years.
We also have Nemours in our backyard who helped. You know, it takes a village. Just.
So where, close to where our programming was, we actually had a farmer's market, but what has happened actually since programming ended, there are certain days of the week that your food stamps, you can get more fruits and vegetables. It's like double days. And that has happened since actually our programming has ended. But they did have pretty good access. What we found the bigger issues was just trying new things, so we incorporated that in the programming where we bring the different fruits and vegetables in and have taste testing days and say, oh, this is pretty good, I want to try that. So that's where our issues were, mainly in just trying the new fruits and vegetables, basically. So, yeah.
Speaking of outcomes, Jen, don't you have some notable ones in blood pressure and inches left? And is it always about the pound?
No.
Liz asked about measurement issues. It is, she's right, it's not about pounds, you know. At the time of the program, people were drinking 2 sodas a day, and that went down to 0. I mean, that alone, what's that, 500 calories? That's a pound per week. 3,500 calories is 1 pound. So that's the difference. Our blood pressure did go down, and as you know, blood pressure is a major, it's actually 1 in 3 of the reasons why people die in America, top reason. So, I mean, there is other modifiable changes. Someone had another question.
Mine is not so much a question, but a comment. I'm foreign born, so I came from the United States in 1968. And as a 12-year-old, and immediately sat on the night at the Prussian school. While in my country, I'm Portuguese. In my country, it was, the comment was translating basically fat as you
would.
Yeah. It's women. You're supposed to be a woman. Yeah. But it was, no, but it was, literally, fat is beauty. There was a certain amount where women have to have a certain amount of meat on their bones. When I go back home,
they call me a quarter.
Because
I've lost 80 pounds.
Yeah,
they call me a quarter.
So that they, you know, the old traditional people had this idea about what women should look like. And the men especially, you know, when I go home, my grandfather was horrified how thin I was, and I wasn't thin. By American standards, I wasn't. But the point I want to make is, I am a product in the 1970s, as a 16-year-old, on my bottle it said amphetamines that I feel legally prescribed by the physician. And my mother takes me there and says, well, you know, you can have this, you know. And so, because that's the culture thing. And ended up with a grand mal seizure.
Yeah, just kind of going along with you, with what you were saying. With my program, we did the evaluations on the BMI, blood pressure, cholesterol. But what I had to do with my participants, there in their minds, they were only looking at their weight and BMI and as their own indicators of success. So what I chose to do with our celebrations, we celebrated whoever had the best numbers, who had the best improvement in blood pressure, cholesterol, so the focus would not just be on the weight, but the whole, you know, because we had been talking about knowing your numbers. So we tried to shift it from just looking at your weight to looking at what are your numbers. What do your numbers look like? And so basically to celebrate those changes that the participant made, and trying to help them to change their goals in a sense, or see the importance of adding these types of things to your goals on the road to getting more health, you know. And one thing I wanted to mention too with our program, I did find, as far as a lesson learned, that the participants whose BMIs were like 55, this program was kind of, should have maybe been a second stage program for them. If you only look at BMI and those types of indicators, because they had problems with some of the equipment and stairs, you know.
So but that's the DFIT program.
Yeah. So I thought this program would have been like a second stage program for them. However, but then they had the camaraderie too, and that's the part, how do you evaluate that, you know? The fact that they had this camaraderie and everybody was kind of helping each other along. You know, so if I was just looking at BMI and how they can get on equipment, I would say really this is, should probably be a second stage program. But then on the other side, they liked being with the other participants. But I had to deal with things with the Y having a policy that you had to wear a swimming suit to get into the pool, where some of these women, there weren't swimming suits, you know, for them. So there were things like that that we had to get through as far as communicating. But my initial point was that dealing with participants and their perception of what success looks like, and it shouldn't just be weight. It needs to be looking at your numbers as well. So,
and I think, too, I had commented, you know, looking at a success of a program is not just looking at, again, those quantitative results, but also the qualitative. I think the responses that we hear back from the participants, we ask questions about, you know, do they have more energy now? Do they sleep better? Do they feel like they are able to play with their children more? And really tap into that overall health and put aside that weight aspect. And then as it relates to women, what we find sometimes as barriers for women, I work with the Latina population, is, you know, talking about the importance of skim milk. Okay, how much fat is in whole milk that you're drinking? And maybe you should go to 2% or 1% in skim. And them saying, well, my husband doesn't want to switch to that, or I don't want to do that. My husband doesn't want to eat healthy. My husband. And so really teaching the women to become passionate about making healthy lifestyle changes for themselves, but also for the health of their family, and spinning it that way, that you're here not only for yourself, but really most often the women that are attending are the ones that are doing the grocery shopping, they're doing the cooking. And so really let's start thinking about your family's health. As you had mentioned, you know, an overweight child, their likelihood of becoming obese as they're older. So talking about that to the women. And so and we found when we did some focus groups before we started our group, what women, why did they want to participate in a group? Not only to lose weight, but they also wanted to be there for their family. What we found when we were doing an awareness campaign is women want to make changes so that they can live longer lives. Not even commenting on the quality of life, but quantity, that they want to be there for their family. And so that's the way we really presented our materials, so that you're here for yourself and for your family, and that women really felt empowered to then go home and make these changes, some very subtle, but like make these changes for the overall health of their family. And I think that for us was a good thing to recognize at the start, so that we could really tailor our program and our evaluation to tap into some of those issues.
The idea of you wanting to change your weight meant that you were interested in other men. Women would have this issue to deal with, and you know, then they have issues of domestic violence associated with that. There's a lot more than that. There's
control.
Food.
A lot of control.
That the women have not only the barrier of changing the food and having to deal with their face, especially if you're married to a man that does not have a weight issue. My husband, of course, now he's dead. But he did not have a weight issue. But now he's dead. And he did not have a weight issue. But he would say, he's not going to be married to a woman who weighs like a rabbit. You know, so you have to deal with all those issues as in the side for your own, plus then everything else associated with it.
I agree.
And as you're speaking about values and perceptions and a lot of things.
So, kind of curious, first of all, were any of your programs, did you provide training in things like motivational interviewing?
Mm-hmm. We have a promotora that leads our program, and so she attended several trainings related to motivational interviewing, and she employs those techniques when she meets with the patient for the first time to give them information about the program and go through an orientation appointment. And then throughout the course of the program, doing goal check-ins really kind of tries to use the motivational interviewing tools to work with that patient. Definitely. We had a promotora when we started the program that we did not have any type of training in, and we actually saw lower retention rates. And so in terms of just keeping women involved in the program, I think the motivational interviewing has helped. And then in women feeling, again, I think spinning it so that it's them setting these goals for themselves. It's them feeling that, like, I can do this, that this is a goal I want to achieve, I think has improved our retention rates, and then also achieving those women are achieving those goals that they have for themselves.
Right. For our community health mentor training, have you heard of BodyWorks? Mm-hmm. So the BodyWorks toolkit has all this. So instead of recreating the wheel, we just tore that thing apart and repackaged it the way we wanted to with Christiana Kaluka. And that has MI stuff in it. So we were unable to use that curriculum to train our mentors. And then they had resources to get it for free for their participants to carry on the program. Go ahead, Terry.
Yes. We have what we call Moms Heal. Moms are with your moms. You know, to talk about empowerment, you know, and I just facilitated, I was just there. But it was like, you know, we're all in a group and the mom. I remember one time we had a lady and she was Asian. And apparently she had left her husband. She had 6 kids. And she didn't tell me all that. But, you know, she came to one of our weight management classes and we did the weight management and then we had the soul line dancing, and she sat there with her kids, and she sat with the kids like this, and then the women started talking, and then she felt more comfortable. This woman had a master's degree. She was a registered nurse. She was all these things, and where she was from, she made money, but she had to escape. So that's what we have, that mom, that region, that mom. It started out as a postpartum, a person support group, but it became a lot of things, you know, under that postpartum.
I say that because I've run programs called Eating for Healthy Tomorrow and weight management programs, and I have discovered that some of the women, they are depressed as well. So we have a comprehensive approach. We have a psychologist, mental health professionals, registered dietitians, nurses, and so forth.
She referred
to be able to address, and I think that's excellent for the support group. But what we were finding that some of this was really, really, it was having an impact
when the
outcomes of it, the health and everything.
And that's what we did as well.
And I think those support groups.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, the La Vida Sana program is run at a FQHC where we have behavioral health services. And so we have actually, when we cover depression, self-esteem, body image within our program, that's when we bring in the therapists to do it. That's the only time that there's not a lay health educator presenting the material. We use professionals. And then at any time through the course of the program, they can then be referred into individual behavioral services, either within Erie, where I work, or we link them with another resource in the city.
Because our depression was so high, we have multiple points of referrals. We have a crisis line because we've had people say they wanted to kill themselves the first day of class. Because that's how deep we go. But we had to have an implementation of crisis intervention on that first class. And then at the third class, we had Mental Health Association of Delaware come in and talk about Beyond Stress, but they actually were licensed therapists and they can actually take on the referrals. And then Terry, on the seventh week, does a Mom's Heal type of program. So we actually have different layers, and we actually did it because we figured by the week 7, they're comfortable to talk about what's going on in that group.
Mm-hmm.
And with my program, we had a multidisciplinary team, and I'm actually was the program coordinator, and I'm a licensed professional counselor. And like I said, I had to just kind of educate the women because I had the resources there, but they didn't want to utilize them because they were in a level of denial. So what I did is when they had a positive depression screen, I just would have a one-on-one with them, and I did a lot of kind of unofficial counseling just because I was their coordinator and I'd built the rapport. And but from that, I was able to connect them and also my community health worker with the agencies that I had partnerships with. Basically made the referrals, and they would take them in, and that's kind of how that process went.
I got to close this.